Kyra Mai, Gwasandra Kailaho, and you're with Safe and Sound, Aotearoa New Zealand's animal rights radio show. We're sponsored by Village Organics here in Hamilton, and they tell me that they've got some kombucha in stock. Just last week I tried kombucha for the first time. One of my teaching assistants makes her own, and she brought it in for the class to try. And for those of you who don't know, it's an ancient Chinese fermented tea and reminded me when I tasted it of ginger beer. Anyhow, it's full of probiotics and antioxidants, B vitamins and other goodies, and I found it quite pleasant to drink. So if you want to try kombucha, head down to Village Organics and they're opposite the Frankton Hotel in Commerce Street, Frankton. Well, today I'm speaking with Australian-British animal ethicist Dr. Andrew Knight, who is a ridiculously busy fellow. He's a European veterinary specialist in animal welfare science, ethics and law. He's a fellow of the Oxford Centre for Animal Ethics. He is a senior fellow of the UK Higher Education Academy and an associate professor of welfare and ethics at Ross University School of Veterinary Medicine in the Caribbean. He's currently Director of Education and Research for SAFE. Kia ora, Andrew. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Look, I got quite exhausted reading your list of accomplishments. You're a vet, a PhD, an extreme sports enthusiast. You're an author. You've won numerous awards. You're making people like me feel bad about ourselves.
I don't think there's any need for that at all. I mean, I think a lot of your listeners will be animal advocates, and I think animal advocates automatically have a couple of important things going for them. One is that in my experience it means that they're willing to think outside the box a bit. In order to achieve academically, it's necessary actually to be willing to question assumptions and to think critically. This is the essence of academic thinking and scientific thinking.
Yes.
So people that naturally have an ability to do that, I think, are more likely to succeed anyway. So I hope it doesn't make people feel bad about themselves.
Of course not. I was just making the point that you're extremely accomplished. Now, listen, there's something that I read that you are interested in the medicine and husbandry of supposedly mythical animals. Can you please explain that?
It's just a little bit of a joke that I have going. I go to many conferences around the world and give talks on various things, and sometimes they're in interesting locations, sometimes there have been mountains nearby, for example, and I'm also a little bit of a mountaineer, and I've often taken side trips and entertain myself. I guess the story I tell my friends is that I'm off looking for the local yeti, whether it's the European yeti or the Peruvian yeti, or a yeti in some other location. I've done quite a lot of that.
I see.
It's a bit of a joke, actually.
I see. I wondered, but I wasn't sure. So,
yeah.
Now, you have obviously enormous energy and stamina. You get that from veganism, do you?
Oh, absolutely. I think the most useful training food is vegan chocolate cake 3 times a day.
Are you a cook? Are you a baker?
I'm extremely good at eating.
Right.
I'm not so good at cooking, unfortunately.
Right.
Thankfully, my partner's quite good at cooking, but not so keen on eating, so we have a
And of course, the other thing about the vegan diet is that it inflicts the least harm on the planet and, of course, on animals.
Of course it does. It's the best choice for so-called food animals, as well as public health, as
That's
well as
right.
having the least environmental burden, CO2 emissions, etc. So, of course, it's the best choice.
Yes. Now, recently you've been appointed Director of Research and Education with SAFE, and you're down there in Wellington in the head office. So how's that going?
That's going great, actually. It's great to be with SAFE. I've had the opportunity to do a lot of work with them already, being up and down the country, giving talks to a number of universities and various conferences on the animal welfare issues of concern to SAFE, and publishing articles on the website and getting involved in various other exciting projects that we've got going.
Right. Did you read last week that the SPCA has launched a program called Compassionate Education in Schools? I think you'd have been quite interested in that.
Yes, actually. We wonder if they've been inspired by our program a bit. We've got an education program which has been very active and successful for about a decade now. We've got a series of textbooks which have gone out to all secondary schools in the country on animal issues, with lessons plans tailored to subjects like biology, social studies, English, science, and so on.
Mm.
And we've got Safe Animal Squad, which is a youth group for children between 8 and 14 years, with a new website that was just very recently launched, where they can play games online, learn interesting facts about animals, and hopefully help them encourage compassionate attitudes towards animals. We've got an active program going.
There's no doubt that your education resources are amazing, and of course we have Nicola Creek to thank for that wonderful series of books that are in just about every school in New Zealand. And I'm sure that SAFE has inspired the SPCA and led the way in compassionate education, and still doing so much good work.
Indeed, I mean, Nicola's been working in this area for about 10 years now, and that's quite an acclaimed set of texts that she has managed to put out for all the secondary schools. And there's been significant interest in translating those to other countries around the world
well.
It's a very good model to be used, I think, internationally.
Now, one of your specialist study areas is animal experimentation. You've studied the costs and benefits of using animals in experiments, the benefits to humans. So what does the evidence state about this?
Well, the evidence is quite clear on this. There are some links between animal experiments and human healthcare advances, which is going to be inevitable whenever you do literally millions and millions of experiments. But the proportion of these that actually go on to provide useful benefits for human patients are very, very low. So as a tool for trying to advance public health, animal experiments is a very inefficient tool for trying to achieve that objective.
Mm.
The costs are pretty high. They're high in terms of financial resources and scientific resources that are consumed by animal research. It's very expensive to conduct this research, and those resources become unavailable to other research fields such as and clinical-based research.
Mm.
The costs are high when human patients and consumers use products which have been tested on animals and are wrongly found to be safe, or when human patients are given drugs that actually have side effects that were not predicted in animal studies, or denied effective treatments because other potentially more useful research pathways have not been followed. So the costs are very high. The costs are also, of course, high to the animals.
Mm.
There are more than 127 million animals used worldwide each year in animal research. So unfortunately, in return for all these costs, the benefits are actually very low. So it's really not an efficient point of advanced human healthcare. And we know all this from the systematic reviews, is what we call them. It's a way of doing a study of a research question. For example, how well does an animal model predict a human outcome in a certain field of research? How often does this kind of research contribute to advancements in the care of human patients? These sorts of studies have actually been done and published in the scientific literature.
Mm.
And the most reliable of these are called systematic reviews, and they have to be done very thoroughly and systematically to get the highest reliability of the results. And there's probably 30 or more of these that have been published now. They almost entirely show that animal research produces minimal tangible benefits in trying to actually help human patients and produce reliable predictions of toxicity, which is what human consumers need when they're using products that have been tested on animals.
Mm.
So that's what the evidence tells us, and it's very clear.
I've always thought that the premise of using animals for human health studies is a bit schizophrenic. In one sense, you're saying, oh, they're not like us. It's okay to treat them this way. And they are like us. And that's why we can study on them and discover ourselves. So there's a fundamental contradiction right there.
There is. It's very interesting, isn't it? It seems there's selective framing of animals depending upon the purpose.
Mm.
On the one hand, some researchers, as you say, like to claim that they're very like human beings, so it's legitimate to use them as a model for human beings when trying to test potential new treatments or toxicity. And on the other hand, they're so different from humans that it's morally all right to do this to animals, but it's not all right to do this to human beings. So it's really diametrically opposite framing depending on the intended purpose.
Yes.
This is not remotely intellectually honest.
So where does the future lie in computer modelling and so on?
Well, there's a whole range of alternatives to invasive animal use. certainly computer modelling is becoming ever more sophisticated. Things like cDNA microarrays, which is a sort of a, it's part of genomics, which is studying genetics. This is a massive and growing field. So looking at, for example, a cell culture that is exposed to a test compound, looking at the impacts on cells and how it affects the activation of certain genes within the cell. You can do that with a compound that is known to be toxic and build up a gene profile, and then you can later on give an unknown compound you don't know that's toxic or not to the same group of cells and compare the genetic expression pattern. So there's a lot of work in terms of genetic prediction, which is going to be a very big area for the future, along with computer modelling. Hopefully also more clinical-based research, more personalised research as well. We're getting into the area of personalised medicine rather than a blanket approach to all patients, recognising that not even all human beings are the same, even if treatments are varying degrees of effectiveness depending on the people. So getting into personalised medicine and also human clinical research, improving the quality of that. So we recognise that human clinical trials are often not predictive for more diverse patient populations because they use groups of healthy young men between 18 and 30 years of age, and they don't predict the wider group very well. So, all these sorts of areas they'll be progressing.
You're with Sandra Kyle on Safe and Sound. I'm speaking today with Dr. Andrew Knight, who's an animal ethicist, a veterinary specialist, and educator. There's so many things I want to cover with you, especially I'd like to get on to so-called pests and compassionate conservation. But just quickly beforehand, I see that you have some YouTube videos advocating vegetarian diets for companion animals. Now, I'm really interested in this because ever since I've been vegetarian, which is just about my whole life, I've been feeding my animals meat. And even since I became vegan about 7 years ago, honestly, it grosses me out to tell you the truth, but I didn't think that I had a choice, but I do. I've been trying now to transition them to the AMI, A-M-I, vegan dog and cat food, and it's slow progress, but I seem to be getting somewhere.
That's great. I think many people are in the same boat. Enormous numbers of people are vegetarian and vegan because they're quite understandably concerned about farm animal welfare, the environment, and their own health. But they're reluctant to make the switch for their companion animals because they think that biologically these animals need meat. Of course, if you think about it a little more deeply, what we know quite clearly is that all these animals need a certain set of nutrients, but none of them need any particular ingredient. And of course, nutrients and ingredients are not the same thing. And there's no scientific reason why you can't supply all the nutrients that are needed for cats, dogs, other animals, different life stages, elderly, neonatal, lactating, pregnant animals using ingredients which are plant-based, synthetic and mineral-based. There's no particular biological requirement for meat per se. So a growing number of diets, the one you mentioned and many others, have been developed in recent years that aim to meet all nutritional requirements of cats and dogs on these vegetarian or vegan diets. And the other reason I think that people are interested in this is because there's sort of growing awareness too that the traditional meat-based commercial diets are not entirely safe in the sense that, firstly, there have been formulation errors in some of these diets, but also there's a high proportion of the meat components are from animals and body parts, which are condemned as being unfit for human consumption. There's a lower quality cut, things like the hooves, the sinews, the tendons, the ligaments, the diseased or cancerous tissues that are condemned as being unfit for human consumption. And we're also concerned, I think, about things like parasitism, bacterial contamination of the meat-based products, drug residues, antibiotics, hormones in countries where there are hormones given as growth hormones. Antibiotics, of course, are routinely given to a large variety of farmed animals.
Yeah.
So I think people are concerned about the quality of the meat-based
standard
diet
food.
And the potential for the vegetarian and vegan ones to supply all the nutrients needed, but without any of the risks that are associated with meat-based diets.
In the time that we've got left, I'd like to look at the subject of pests, which I put in inverted commas. And on our show, we've done several episodes on possums. You're probably aware, as an Australian, that you love them in your country, but we loathe them in this country.
Yes, and they're very popular in Australia.
And rightly so. They're cute little critters. But of course, here, they don't have any natural predators, and they're stripping our forests. So we're taught to despise them, and we even teach our children to hate them. In fact, one of our presenters, Lindley Tulloch, a couple of months ago photographed some baby possums being drowned by a teenage girl at a Drury School gala. And as a result of that, the story went international, and renowned author Dr. Mark Beckhoff became involved in it. So I think a lot of people found that really shocking, that a young girl was taking little joeys from their dead mother's pouch and dropping them into water where they died painfully. Now, a couple of aspects I'd like you to address, if you wouldn't mind. The first is the very distinction that we make between native and introduced or exotic species. We think one is good and the other bad. Biologically, it makes no sense to make this distinction. And so why is it okay to poison some sentient creatures in order to save other sentient creatures?
Yeah, there was a very interesting academic article on this just published recently talking about the demonisation of possums that has occurred in New Zealand, because that certainly is what's occurred. The level of hatred of possums that has been encouraged by some governmental policies, by various media stories, by activities such as school possum killing days. And the Drury School event that you mentioned before, by the way, was publicised internationally. The school put a video online of these baby possums being pulled out of the pouches of the mothers that had been killed and then drowned in a bucket of water by a teenager. That video went around the world and attracted international condemnation, quite understandably. So clearly there's a level of demonisation that's been going on in this country of possums, as described in the academic article I read that looked into this in some depth. And it seems to be that part of the reason for this is to actually draw attention away, whether it's sort of deliberately or not, from the main cause of environmental destruction in this country, which, of course, is unfortunately colonisation by Europeans.
Yes.
Actually, the mass clearing previously of forests from very large portions of this country, primarily for cattle and sheep farming, is by far the main cause of environmental destruction. The ongoing dairy industry in this country and the pollution of the waterways and the greenhouse gas emissions from the cattle and particularly from the clearing of forest to grow concentrates to feed to the cattle and to provide pasture. Now, these things have a far, far greater impact on the environment and on native animals than possums ever could, really. So by focusing attention so strongly on possums in this way, it allows people to avoid thinking about the real causes of the environmental destruction and loss of native species in New Zealand.
If an individual animal has any value, then it is not according to their species, is it? A rat has as much intrinsic value as a kokako, is that correct?
Yes, I mean, if you look at this issue sensibly and consider what actually are the important characteristics of an animal that ought to be determining how much moral status the animal has, how much ethical consideration the animal is given, then you consider things such as whether the animal is sentient or not, whether it's able to experience pain or positive or pleasurable states, things like the importance of social relationships, social bonds to the animal, things like that. And when you do that, there's clearly no difference between another mammal such as a
possum
mouse, a stoat, and a possum, or for that matter, a dog or a pig.
So we've all heard a lot about predator-free 2050, and the government is encouraging communities and schools and so on to buy into it. But rather than eradicate with all the problems involved with 1080 drops and the wholesale slaughtering of animals considered pests, shouldn't we be having another approach that is more resilient and is better going forward?
Sure. I mean, predator-free 2050 is a wonderful slogan. It's a great soundbite. It allows the government to look like it's doing something bold and taking strong steps to address this issue. It allows everybody that gets involved in it to feel good about themselves in this way, and it gives people a way to feel like they're doing something without thinking about the real causes of environmental destruction and species loss in this country, which of course is European colonisation and farming on a wide scale, particularly animal agriculture. Mm. Which uses so much more land than plant-based agriculture. Apart from all of that, the problem is it's not actually effective and it's inhumane. So regarding effectiveness, whenever very large proportions of toxic baits, such as 1080 baits, are dumped in areas of native forests, the remaining areas, in an attempt to kill these introduced animals, it doesn't kill all of them. And very quickly, the survivors, having discovered that many of their competitors have died, the survivors have got better access to food, more territory, and do very well. And they breed, and they breed up to fill
existing
the
numbers,
ecological carrying capacity of the ecological niche that they're within. So rat populations, for example, bounce back to where they were
very quickly,
6 and 18 months after the initial drop. The second problem is this is grossly inhumane. You very rarely see this mentioned in government publications promoting this program, but as a matter of fact, 1080, which has been described as being moderately inhumane, 1080 actually causes, after a period of depression and lethargy, causes vomiting, hyperextension of the limbs, convulsions, seizures, collapse, followed by cardiac and respiratory arrest. Mm. That is not remotely humane. That is not moderate suffering.
No.
That is severe suffering.
No.
This goes on for hours, and it also affects native species.
Non-targeted,
1080 is indiscriminate. Mm. It's often promoted as being selective for killing possums as well as rats and stoats, but as a matter of fact, that's not true. Mm. A wide variety of species are actually affected by 1080, including species like dogs owned by hikers that go through native forests and consume these laced baits when they find them.
Look, it's been so informative talking to you, but that's our time now. I'm thinking that maybe we'll get you back at some stage soon and we'll just talk about predator-free 2050 in a little bit more depth, and we'll put it all right by proposing alternatives that are more humane, more effective, more resilient, and will adapt us for the future. How does that sound?
I mean, that would be great. There's so much to talk about. Immunocontraception would be a big thing that I would talk about.
Yes, excellent. We'll do that, Andrew. So until the next time, we'll sign off now, and thank you again. All the best.
Thank you, Sandra. It's good to have been on the show.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our thanks to Dr. Andrew Knight. So please keep listening to Safe and Sound. We hope to have that program solely dedicated to predator-free 2050 in the upcoming weeks. We'll go out today on an extraordinary piece of music. When it first came out in the mid-1970s, it was accompanied by a promotional video that was striking and dramatic and captivating, just like the song itself. I'm referring to The Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen. The connection with animal rights is that lead guitarist Brian May is an animal advocate. In particular, he campaigns against fox hunting in the UK and also badger culling. So as we listen to those familiar strains, I bid you farewell until next time. Thank you, everyone. Mā tiwā. Bye-bye.
Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies and see. I'm just a poor boy, I need no sympathy, because I'm easy come, easy go, little high, little low. Any way the wind blows doesn't really matter to me. Mama just killed a man.
Mamma mia, let me go. Beelzebub has a devil put aside.